Hi, class. Of course, last class we had been discussing the Louisiana sources of law. We had talked about primary or authoritative sources of law, and I gave you several examples of those under legislation and custom. Then we also talked about secondary or persuasive sources of law. We talked about the examples of that. We also discussed the distinction between primary and secondary sources of law. So that wrapped up our Roman numeral 1 in our class outline, the Louisiana sources of law. We then moved and discussed the Louisiana Civil Code, how it's set up, and what courses you will learn the material in each book of the Civil Code in. So that led us into our discussion of Roman numeral 3, obligations in general. And we talked about the fact last class that an obligation is more than just contract, that in fact a contract is just one example or one type of an obligation. And we then moved to discussing part B under Roman numeral 3, which was the definition of an obligation. And I told you guys that most people think of an obligation as a duty, but that's somewhat short-sighted, because usually, but not always, an obligation is not going to be a one-way street. Instead, it's going to have two sides, a duty and a corresponding right. In fact, Louisiana Civil Code Article 1756 defines an obligation as a legal relationship whereby a person, called the obligor, is bound to render a performance in favor of another, called the obligee. So I told you that, per that definition, there are sort of three parts to an obligation. One, you have to have a legal relationship. Two, you have to have your subjects, two parties. And three, you have to have an object. So breaking down those three parts, the first I said was a legal relationship or a legal bond. And what this is a relationship recognized by the law and enforced by the law. It's different from a moral relationship. For example, you may have a duty under your religion to go to church, but the law doesn't recognize or enforce this duty. So to have an obligation, you need some sort of relationship that, again, is recognized and enforced by the law. The second thing you're going to need, besides that legal relationship or legal bond, are your subjects. You're going to need two parties. Now, these two parties are called the obligor and the obligee. The obligor is the one who is bound to perform the obligation or the duty. The obligor can also be called the debtor or the passive subject. On the flip side of that, the obligee is the one who receives the performance. So he or she is also called a creditor or the active subject. Now, in most contracts, and we're going to learn more about this later in the semester, but in most contracts, each person in an obligation will be both the obligor and the obligee. Now, that may sound a little crazy, but let me give you an example. Let's take a contract of sale. For example, let's say I'm going to sell you a car. So in that relationship, I'm the obligor in that as the seller, I'm bound to deliver the car to you, and I have to warrant certain things with regard to that car, that it's going to be free of defects, et cetera, et cetera. So on the one hand, I'm the obligor. I have to perform. I have certain duties. Like I said, deliver the car and warrant certain things. But on the flip side of that, I'm also the obligee. I'm entitled to receive your performance in that I'm entitled to receive payment for the car. So that's my side of the obligation. I'm both the obligor and the obligee. You also are the obligor and the obligee. Let's look at that for a second. You're the obligor in that you have to perform. You have to pay the price according to our sales contract. But you're also the obligee in that you are entitled to have it delivered to you and have certain warranties with regard to it. So again, in most contracts, each person is both the obligor and the obligee. So that kind of wraps up the discussion of the subjects. So we've seen the legal relationship in an obligation that you have to have one. We've seen the subjects, obligor and obligee. The third requirement for an obligation is the object. This, of course, is just the performance that the obligee expects and that the obligor must render. So that's what an obligation is. And I will also say that an obligation is essentially the foundation of all personal relationships between an obligee and an obligor. So that wraps up Part B of Roman numeral 3, the definition of an obligation. We move then to Part C of Roman numeral 3, and that is the two types of obligations. Now, there are going to be other classifications that we go through as we move into obligations in general next semester. But for purposes of this class, we're focusing on two different types of obligations or two classifications. Those two classifications are a natural obligation is the first, and then a legal or a civil obligation is the other. So what we're going to do now is just talk for a second, or for a while actually, about a natural obligation. So what's the definition of a natural obligation? Louisiana Civil Code Article 1760 gives that to you. It says, a natural obligation arises from circumstances in which the law implies a particular moral duty to render a performance. So what that tells you right off the bat about a natural obligation is it's an obligation that exists only in a moral sense. So going back to the definition of an obligation, it's not a true obligation because it's not legally enforceable. It's not a legal bond existing between obligor and obligee. Again, a natural obligation exists only in a moral sense, so it's not going to be legally enforceable. Basically, it's where a person should do the right thing, but the law does not require it. So, for example, you know, you may be obligated under the rules of your religion to tithe at church. So when the offering plate comes around, you're supposed to put some money in it, but that's just a natural obligation or a moral obligation. It's not a legally recognized obligation or bond. So that's the definition of a natural obligation. The next question that you may have is, how does a natural obligation arise? Well, if we look at Louisiana Civil Code Article 1762, we're going to get several examples. That article starts with examples of circumstances giving rise to a natural obligation are, and then it's going to list different situations that would give rise to a natural obligation. So we're going to go through each of those examples one by one, and I'm actually going to take them out of order. So I'm going to give you four different examples per Article 1762. And I will go ahead and tell you that this list is what we call in the civil law illustrative. That means these are just examples. These are not the only ways that a natural obligation could come up. So it's not an exclusive list. So what are those four examples? Well, subsection 2 tells you that an example of circumstances giving rise to a natural obligation is when an obligation has been incurred by a person who, although endowed with discernment, lacks legal capacity. Now, there are some words in there that you may not be entirely familiar with, like legal capacity and discernment. Well, the word discernment is a situation where someone doesn't understand what they're doing. And there may be various people out there who don't understand what they're doing when they enter into a contract. It may be a very young person. It may be a person deprived of reason. It may be an interdict. But if you notice from the phrase in the civil code, it has to be a person who lacks legal capacity but has discernment. So what we're talking about here is a person who does understand what they're doing, but because of the rules of the civil code under the law, they lack legal capacity. So who might that be? I mean, for example, you may have a 17-year-old kid who fully understands what they're doing in a contract. But, so they have discernment, but they still lack legal capacity because, as we're going to learn later in the semester, all unemancipated minors are presumed to, or actually lack legal capacity. So that's the situation we're typically looking at. You've got someone who knows what they're doing, but the law still says they can't have legal capacity. And if they don't have legal capacity, then they can't enter into a contract, and that contract's going to be null. So when you have a person who lacks legal capacity but has discernment and they enter a contract, that contract is null. What that means is there's no legal obligation created from it. However, per Article 1762, that minor or that person who lacks legal capacity but has discernment still owes a natural obligation to perform according to the contract. Now, remember, though, if he or she doesn't perform under this natural obligation, the obligee cannot go to court and legally enforce the obligation because it's not a legal obligation. It's just a natural one, and natural obligations are not legally enforceable. So that was example one of how a natural obligation arises, when a person lacks legal capacity but has discernment. Okay, the second example of how a natural obligation arises comes from subsection 3 of Article 1762, which says, examples of circumstances giving rise to a natural obligation are when the universal successors are not bound by a civil obligation to execute the donations and other dispositions made by a deceased person that are null for want of form. Okay. The situation that we have here is a person has died, and they have left a document behind that purports to be their last will and testament. And in it, they say who they want their things to go to. But for some reason, the person who is now deceased did not follow the proper form requirements for a testament. So as an aside, you'll learn all of this in your successions and donations classes here at Loyola. Under Louisiana law, there are only two forms that are acceptable for a testament. You have your oleographic testament, and then you have your notarial testament. Now, an oleographic testament is one written, dated, and signed all in the hand of the testator. A notarial testament is a way more formal document. It has to be an authentic act, which requires a notary and two witnesses. It has all sorts of requirements that you'll learn in later classes, like the testator has to sign on every single page. The witnesses have to sign attestation clauses, lots of various rules. So the only way to have a valid testament in Louisiana is for it to either be oleographic or notarial. So what we've got in the context of a natural obligation is a dead person who has a document in which he leaves his stuff to certain people, but that testament is not in oleographic or notarial form. So therefore, it's going to be null. Well, in that situation, his successors do not have any sort of legal obligation to give the things mentioned in that document to the people that the dead person said he wanted it to go to. However, they do have a natural obligation to do so. Now, again, what happens if the successors won't turn over those things to those people? Can those people go to court and enforce their right? No, because this is simply a natural obligation, which is not legally enforceable. So that was the second example of a natural obligation. The third one comes from Civil Code Article 1762, subsection 1. And that article says, examples of circumstances giving rise to a natural obligation are when a civil obligation has been extinguished by prescription. Okay, so at this point in your legal career, you probably don't even know what prescription is. So as an aside, I'll give you a brief overview of how prescription works. Now, under Louisiana law, there are actually three different types of prescription. You can look at Louisiana Civil Code Article 3445 if you want to look this up. The three types of prescription are liberative prescription, quizzitive prescription, and the prescription of non-use. Suffice it to say right now in this class, anytime I talk about prescription, I'm talking about liberative prescription. And liberative prescription per Article 3447 is a mode of barring of actions as a result of inaction for a period of time. So, for example, let's say that you and I are in a car accident. I rear-end you. I cause property damage to your car and personal injury damages to your body. Under Louisiana law, this is a tort. So the law provides that you, as the obligee there, have 1 year to bring your claim for your damages. If you don't, your claim is then prescribed. It is barred. Your action is barred as a result of your inaction for that certain period of time, that 1 year. So when we have that situation where, you know, the obligee doesn't bring his or her claim in a timely fashion under the prescription laws, I, as the obligor, I don't have a legal obligation to perform. I have no legal obligation to give you damages for your property or for your bodily injury. However, I do have a natural obligation to do so. So again, though, what is your option at this point? You don't really have one because you cannot go to court and bring your claim because it's simply a natural obligation that I have to pay you. It is not legally enforceable in court. So that's example three of how a natural obligation arises. Example four can be found in subsection 1 of 1762. It says that when the obligor of an obligation fails to perform as he is supposed to, and then he declares bankruptcy, what will happen in that situation? His debts, or at least most of them, will be discharged in the bankruptcy. So the obligor no longer has a legal obligation to pay his creditors. However, he does still have a natural obligation to do so. So if you're a creditor of someone who declares bankruptcy, that person, your debtor, has a natural obligation to pay you. So what does this mean again for you? Can you go running into court and force him to pay up? No, because this is a natural obligation he has and it is not legally enforceable. So essentially, those are the four examples given by the Civil Code. Again, there are other examples that could arise. That list is simply illustrative. And that kind of wraps up the discussion of how a natural obligation arises. But if you're following along on your reading list and hypotheticals, you will see at this point several hypos designed to illustrate these principles. So if you look at hypothetical one, it says, Vanessa runs Zach over in the parking lot on September 1st, 2011, causing him to sustain personal injury. Zach files suit against her, Vanessa, on October 1st, 2012. There was a legal obligation between Vanessa and Zach at one time, but is there now? Why or why not? If not, does that mean there's no obligation at all? Why or why not? Okay, so based on the information I gave you just a few minutes ago about how a natural obligation arises, you should be able to answer this question. So the answer is there's no longer a legal obligation. Zach's claim, which was based in tort, is prescribed by the passage of a year's time. However, Vanessa owes Zach a natural obligation. Hypothetical 2 says, Scout, Demi's 15-year-old daughter, agrees to sell Cameron, who knows Scout's age, her brand new car for $100. Sometime later, before the car is delivered, Scout changes her mind. Question, can Cameron sue to force Scout to deliver the car? Why or why not? If not, does that mean that there's no obligation at all between Scout and Cameron now? Why or why not? The answer is, Cameron cannot force Scout to deliver the car. Scout is a minor, and therefore she lacks capacity to enter into a contract. However, Scout owes Cameron a natural obligation. She lacks legal capacity, but she has discernment, we'll assume. Hypothetical 3 says, Sergeant, Maria's elderly father, realizing that he's about to die, stumbles over to his 1950 edition Smith Corona manual typewriter and hammers out a document that he entitles Last Will and Testament. In it, he purports to leave everything to my beloved daughter and only child, Maria, except my collection of Beatles LPs, which I leave to my beloved grandson, Patrick. After pulling the sheet from the typewriter and signing and dating it, he drops dead. Can Patrick invoke legal process to force Sergeant's estate to execute the special bequest that Sergeant left him, i.e., to turn over the Beatles records to him? Why or why not? If not, then who gets the records? Why? Is there now no sort of obligation between that person and Patrick? Explain. The answer is no, Patrick cannot force the estate to execute the bequest. The will that Sergeant executed is invalid under Louisiana law. Remember, an holographic will requires one to write it, sign it, and date it in their hand. He didn't do this under these facts. He typed it. Or it could be notarial, but there's no mention in the facts of a witness, of witnesses or a notary or any other of the special requirements to have an holographic will. So therefore, this will is invalid. Thus, under the rules of intestacy, which will be triggered because the will is found invalid, it's like it doesn't exist, these rules of intestacy say that all of Sargent's property goes intestate to Maria, including the Beatles records. Now, Maria has no legal obligation to give those records to Patrick. However, she does owe him a natural obligation. And that wraps up our discussion of how a natural obligation arises. The next thing we need to talk about with regard to natural obligations is the effect of a natural obligation. The important thing to remember about a natural obligation is that there is no reciprocity. Basically, under Article 1761, a natural obligation is not enforceable by judicial action. So an obligor has a duty, even though it's just a natural obligation, but like I've been saying all along, the obligee has no enforcement mechanism. In other words, the obligee has no right to bring an action to make the obligor perform. So, again, the obligor is bound only in a moral sense. But I must mention at this point, Article 1761, the second sentence, what it says is, nevertheless, whatever has been freely performed in compliance with a natural obligation may not be reclaimed. So, if the obligor has a natural obligation under one of the scenarios we've already talked about, and he performs that obligation freely, okay? We're going to learn more about free later in this semester, but for purposes here, what free means is that the obligor performs without being put under any fraud or any duress. Like I said, we'll learn that later. But let's say the obligor of this natural obligation does perform and does so freely. Per Article 1761, the second sentence, that obligor cannot reclaim his performance. Regardless of whether he thought it was a natural obligation or a legal obligation, he can't get his performance back. So let me give you an example here. Let's say that I owe you $100 on a promissory note that I signed in your favor back in 2005. but I never made a payment. Okay, so I owe you $100. I signed a document saying that I owe you $100, but I never made a payment. So in 2011, you bring a lawsuit against me. So at this point, you may be going, that's been 6 years. And if you're thinking that way, you're thinking on the right track, because prescription on a promissory note is 5 years. So what this means is you, in bringing your action 6 years later, are untimely. So, in other words, your claim against me has prescribed. So I don't owe you a legal obligation, but what do I owe you? I owe you a natural obligation. So let's say that I start feeling bad. I'm like, oh, I know that I owe that person that money, and even though it's prescribed and I know they can't go to court and make me pay, I'm a good person, and I want to do the right thing. So I pay you the $100. But a few days later, let's say that I get mad at you. You do something to upset me or make me mad. And so I'm like, you know what? I didn't have to pay you that $100. Your claim was prescribed, so I want my $100 back. What's the answer there? Can I get my $100 back? No, because I performed, and I did so freely. You didn't exert any fraud or duress on me. So therefore, whatever I have freely performed in compliance with my natural obligation may not be reclaimed. I cannot get my money back. So looking at this whole idea, let's look at a couple of hypotheticals, actually just one, hypothetical four. Hypothetical four says, as he was driving past Louisiana Vineyard one day, Mark Paul lost control of his Jeep and veered straight into Brecken's wine vineyards, destroying a good bit of the crop. Time rolled by. Then one day, about 18 months later, Brecken reminded Mark Paul of the accident, saying that Mark Paul owed him the value of the lost grapes and demanded that he pay up immediately. Mark Paul made the payment. The very next day, Mark Paul ran into Malcolm. When Mark Paul told Malcolm what had happened the day before, Malcolm shouted, "You dummy! You didn't owe Brecken anything at all. His claim against you prescribed 6 months ago." Mark Paul then marched over to Louisiana Vineyard, where he demanded that Brecken return the payment. Brecken refused. Mark Paul then sued Brecken, seeking to recover what Mark Paul described as the payment of a thing not due. Who wins and why? The answer is Brecken wins. Even though Mark Paul only had a natural obligation, remember the claim of Brecken's against Mark Paul had prescribed, so he couldn't have brought an action against Mark Paul, so Mark Paul had just simply a natural obligation. However, and he didn't have to pay it. However, he did pay it, and he did so freely without any fraud or duress by Brecken. So as a result, per Article 1761, second sentence, Mark Paul cannot reclaim his performance. Now, the last thing we need to talk about with regard to natural obligations is the fact that in certain circumstances, a natural obligation can be converted into a legal obligation. Now, in order to understand this principle, I've assigned you guys a case called Succession of Harrison. And I'm going to go through the facts of the case and what the court ruled and try to highlight why this case is an example of the conversion of a natural obligation into a legal obligation. This case is also a helpful one in showing how a natural obligation can arise because it regards an invalid testament. So, Succession of Harrison. In the Succession of Harrison case, Emmanuel Harrison died, and he left behind several people in his family. He left behind his second wife, a sister, a brother, 10 nieces and nephews of one of his dead brothers, and then 3 nieces and nephews of his dead sister. He also had a foster child named John. Now, Emmanuel left behind, besides these people, he also left a document, and it was written and dated and signed by somebody else. then Emmanuel went back and signed that same document himself in pencil. Now, what he did in that document was several things. First of all, he said that he wanted his debts paid off. Then he said that he wanted 100 acres that he owned in East Feliciana Parish to go to his foster child, John, and John's kids. He also had a lot in North Baton Rouge that he owned, and he said that he wanted that lot to go to John and John's kids. And then finally, he had a lot of personal property, like movable property, just his stuff, that he also, in that document, said he wanted to leave to John and John's kids. Now, this is great. Emmanuel has died, and he has left his document saying who he wants to get what. But there's a slight problem, because this document is not a valid testament. And the reason that it's not a valid testament is that it does not fit the form requirements of Louisiana testaments. It's not an oligraphic testament because it's not in his hand. The only thing written in his handwriting is his signature. It's also not a notarial testament because there's no notary or witnesses. So what this means for practical purposes is that all of Emmanuel's property is going to go intestate. Now, I know you don't know the rules of intestacy. You've not taken succession at all. But suffice it to say that foster children get nothing under the rules of intestacy. Okay? So you've got Emmanuel saying he wants all his stuff to go to his foster child, John, and John's kids, but the document he executed is no good, so it has no effect. So you've got these default rules jumping in, and it's going to leave pretty much everything to his siblings and then the children of his dead siblings, and certain properties going to go to his second wife. Like I said, that is really beyond the scope of this question of this class. The point being, John's not getting anything under the laws of intestacy. So 12 of his heirs, these relatives that he left behind, signed a document. I'm going to call it the document. And in that document that these 12 heirs signed, they asked the court to give effect to the quote-unquote testament that Emmanuel had executed. Now, what they could have done, what one of the heirs actually did later, they could have accepted the succession or their portion of it and then either give or sell their inheritance rights to John, okay? They could have done that to make sure John gets the stuff, because some of these people felt really badly. They were like, you know, Emmanuel left this quote-unquote testament saying he wanted John and John's kids to get all this stuff, but because of a little technicality, his wishes aren't going to be upheld. So some of them felt badly, and they said, you know, we want John and John's kids to get Emmanuel's stuff because that's what Emmanuel wanted. So one of the heirs, like I said, accepted the succession and then turned around and donated the inheritance rights to John. 12 of them signed the document just saying, hey, court, look, we know that Emmanuel wanted his stuff to go to John and John's kids, so we're asking you to give effect to that quote-unquote testament. All right. So this is what's going on. And then we have one person appointed to be the administrator of the succession. First, it was John. But he actually ends up getting kicked out as administrator because he didn't file an accounting like he was supposed to do. When John gets kicked out, Minor gets appointed as the administrator of the succession. Now, let me tell you, Minor was one of the heirs who did not sign the document asking the court to give effect to Emmanuel's quote-unquote testament. Minor ends up later resigning as administrator of the succession. Then finally, we get Edward appointed as succession administrator. He is also an heir who did not sign the document asking the court to give effect to Emmanuel's quote-unquote testament. So when Edward takes over as administrator, he does something that actually causes this whole case to arise and to be in our book and for us to be talking about it. What he did, he petitioned the court to sell some of the land to pay off some estate debts And then he also petitioned the court to partition the estate. When you partition, that means to divide it up. Now, this land that Edward is asking the court to allow him as administrator to sell was land that was in Emmanuel's quote-unquote testament and left to John and John's kids. He wants to sell it to Minor, one of the relatives who hadn't signed the document, a woman named Annie Bell who had signed the document, and five of his, Edward's, siblings. And the court gets his petition in which he is asking to sell the land that Emmanuel had bequeathed to John, and the court allows him to do it. John, of course, freaks out. He's like, Emmanuel wanted me to have that land. So he files a petition opposing the sale. Now, on what basis could he try to oppose the sale? Well, he claims that he owns 13/15 of the property in question. Now, where would he get 13/15? Well, from the 12 heirs who signed the document asking the court to give effect to Emmanuel's quote-unquote testament, that would give 12/15, and then the other 1/15 would come from that person, that heir who accepted the succession and then turned around and gave the inheritance rights to John. So he says, you know, own 13/15 of this property that Edward's trying to sell. He also says, look, this property is worth way more than Edward is trying to sell it for. So there's kind of some shady stuff maybe going on that Edward's trying to sell this property for a really low price to his own relatives. And then he also says, he's like, look, I mean, and this sale is not necessary to pay Emmanuel's debt. So John's mad. He's like, don't sell this land. It's part, most of it is mine. You're trying to sell it at a low price, and you don't need to sell it to pay off Emmanuel's debt anyway. So Knox has to come back. You know, Edward Knox is the guy who has petitioned to sell the land as administrator. John has come back opposing the sale. Now Edward steps up, and he's like, John, dude, you don't have an interest in this property at all, so you have no right to be challenging my request to sell the land. So the trial court gets this dispute, and it says, hey, you know, we're going to rule in Edward Knox's favor because this document that you know, these 12 heirs have signed asking us to recognize John's rights, you know, for Emmanuel's defective testament, that document itself is null and without effect. Now, the trial court did set aside the order allowing the sale because the price was too low. Now you've got a ruling by the trial court that this document that was going to give John 12/15 interest in the property, they said that that document is null and it has no effect. So John is like, oh no, that gave me most of my interest in this property. So John appeals the ruling. So it goes up to the Court of Appeals. And what do? Well, the Court of Appeals reverses the trial court. And thus, the Court of Appeals finds that the document that these 12 heirs signed was given in fulfillment of a natural obligation. So the Court of Appeals says the document then converted a natural obligation into a legal obligation. Well, at this point, Edward's upset. He's like, oh, I don't like that. So he then appeals to the Louisiana Supreme Court, which is the opinion we have in front of us. And what does the Louisiana Supreme Court do? The Louisiana Supreme Court finds that the heirs had a natural obligation under the code articles to execute the donations that Emmanuel had made in his invalid testament. Now, because the heirs had a natural obligation, when they executed the document, this is valid cause for that document. We'll learn more about cause later. So, in essence, this document is binding. So, this sort of scenario gives you a great real-life example of how a natural obligation, which is not legally enforceable, the natural obligation being that you know, Emmanuel left his stuff to John and John's kids, but he did so in an invalid testament. The heirs had a natural obligation to do what Emmanuel wanted, but at that point, they had no legal obligation. But when they executed that document, the 12 of them anyway, when they executed that document then converted their natural obligation into a legal one. And that pretty much wraps up our discussion of a natural obligation. There is one other thing that I would like to point out about natural obligations, and we can see a great example of this point I'm going to make about natural obligations in the case of state versus flag. Now, you know that based on the definition of a natural obligation, it is one where somebody just has sort of a moral duty based on their conscience to do something, right? So what if you're not talking about a human being, you're talking about maybe a juridical person? Now, you may be saying at this point, what in the heck is a juridical person? If you look at Article 24 of the Civil Code, it tells you there are two types of persons in Louisiana. One is a natural person and one is a juridical person. A natural person is a human being. So what's a juridical person? A juridical person is an entity, essentially, to which the law attributes legal personality. So when we talk about a juridical person, we're talking about corporations, we're talking about LLCs, we're talking about the state of Louisiana, and other governing bodies. Now, you can see there are natural persons, there are juridical persons, and the question that can be raised with regard to a natural obligation is if it's a moral conscience-type feeling that gives rise to a natural obligation, can an entity that's not a human being have that sort of moral conscience, and thus can that entity have a natural obligation? Well, that's where state versus plat comes in. Now, this is sort of a convoluted, confusing case factually, and I'm going to try to lay this out as clear as I can, but it's not so much the facts that I want you to focus on. It's more on what this case means for natural obligation. So, state versus plat. All right, procedurally, this is sort of a mess because there are actually two different lawsuits discussed in this opinion. So let's take the first one for a second. The first lawsuit, you have the parents of a child who is injured during and after birth. These parents are the plaintiffs in the first lawsuit. Now, who do they sue? They sue the state-owned medical facility where their child was injured. So essentially what you've got here is a medical malpractice claim. So this lawsuit goes to court, and the state of Louisiana is found liable. So the damages are assessed at $3 million plus interest initially, but they're later reduced to $500,000 because there's a statutory cap on medical malpractice awards that you'll learn in your torts class. It goes up to the Court of Appeal, who says, yeah, the state is liable, but we're only going to give each plaintiff, the mom and the dad, $100,000. They say that the cap, the statutory cap, is for each plaintiff. So $500,000 each is the max they can get. It then goes up to the Supreme Court, and they reverse. They still say the state is liable, but they say when you have medical malpractice claim, there's a cap of a single cap of $500,000. So while the case is going through the appeals process, something's going to happen that gives rise to the second lawsuit, which is actually the one we're most worried about here. What happened at this point was the counsel for the plaintiffs wrote a letter to the state saying, you know, you owe us a certain amount of money. And the state responded to that letter and said, look, we're not paying you anything until the Supreme Court makes a decision. And so after the Supreme Court makes its decision, the counsel for the plaintiffs wrote another letter with an updated figure saying, this is how much you, the state, owe us. Well, the state gets the letter and they send a check, but the problem is the check the state sent was for way more than what the state actually owed the plaintiff. It was an overpayment made by the state of about $700,000. So when the state realizes, oops, we just paid $700,000 more than we were supposed to, it brought the second lawsuit. And this is the lawsuit we're worried about. So in this suit, the state is the plaintiff, and the parents, their last name is Connerly, by the way, they are the defendant, along with their attorneys and the law firm that was representing them. So what the trial court did, they said, look, the state is entitled to the return of the $700,000 overpayment. So who's going to have to pay back that $700,000? Just as an aside, we've got the Connerlys, the attorneys, their law firm. They're all going to be solidarily bound, which we're going to learn about later in the second semester. That's not the important part. So on appeal, it goes up to the Second Circuit, and they are going to have to address whether the state had a natural obligation. What they decide is that, no, the state does not have a natural obligation. Why not? Well, what the Second Circuit says, essentially, is that a juridical person like the state is not capable of feeling a moral compulsion or a duty of conscience so intense that it can be appeased only by satisfying the duty. So we learn in State v. Plaque some new requirements for a natural obligation that are not laid out in the Civil Code. According to State v. Plaque, there are four requirements in order to have a natural obligation, and I'll list each of them separately for you. One, the moral duty must be felt towards a particular person, not all persons. Two, the person involved must feel so strongly about the moral duty that he truly feels he owes a debt. Three, the duty can be fulfilled through rendering a performance whose object is pecuniary. If you don't know what pecuniary means, that is like measurable in money. Then four, a recognition of the obligation by the obligor must occur, either by performing the obligation or by promising to perform. So those four are now requirements for a natural obligation, at least according to the Second Circuit in State v. Plaque. So let's take the first one. The moral duty must be felt towards a particular person, not all persons. So what does the Second Circuit say about the state's moral duty owed to a particular person? What it says is that if the state could even owe a moral duty, which they can't, that we'll see in just a second, it would owe it to a class of people, to all people awarded damages in excess of the statutory cap. It would not owe the duty just to these particular people, the Connerlys, the plaintiffs. So let's take the second requirement, that the person involved feels so strongly about the moral duty that he truly feels he owes a debt. What does the court say about the state in this regard? Well, what it says is the state clearly has expressed that it does not feel it has a moral duty or that it owes a debt. What the court says is, you know, the state, through the Louisiana legislature, has passed a law that Med-Mal awards are limited to $500,000. So the state obviously could not feel then that it owed the Connerlys any amount over that. So third and fourth requirements here are actually satisfied. The performance had an object that was pecuniary, and the obligor actually performed the obligation by paying extra money. So that sort of wraps up this whole idea about juridical persons and natural obligations. Essentially, it's going to be really hard when you have a juridical person to find that that entity has a natural obligation because it has to feel a moral duty, and it had to feel it towards a particular person. It's got to feel so strongly about it that it's going to feel that it owes a debt. And then, you know, that duty has to be fulfilled through rendering performance whose object is pecuniary, and the entity has to perform or promise to perform. So that wraps up our discussion of natural obligations, which is just one of the two types of obligations. And next class, what we're going to move on to is the other type of obligation, and that's the legal or civil obligation. And just as a heads up, after we discuss the legal and civil obligations, that's the only type of obligation we're going to be worried about at all in this class. So what I've told you about natural obligations is the extent of what you have to know about them. And at this point forward, anything I say about obligation, I'm talking about a legal or civil obligation. So that wraps it up. Thank you guys for listening and for your attention. If you have any questions about any of this, do not hesitate to contact me by email, come see me in my office, et cetera, et cetera. Have a great day. Thanks.